From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 400 years ago Saturday, April 23rd, 1616, William Shakespeare died. His Macbeth told us life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. But Shakespeare's plays still signify a lot, at a depth we need. We're going to dip into some of these plays in this anniversary year of Shakespeare's death. This hour on Point, Othello, Shakespeare's great play of race, love, gender, revenge, and we will look later in this hour at the new visual album from Beyoncé. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Ayanna Thompson, professor of English at George Washington University, author of Passing Strange, Shakespeare, Race, and Contemporary America. She wrote the introduction to the Arden edition of Othello this year. Ayanna Thompson, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
And from New York, John Douglas Thompson joins us. His breakout role was Othello in a 2009 production in Providence, Rhode Island, and then in New York, for which he won an Obie, or Off-Broadway Theater Award. Ben Brantley of the New York Times called him, quoting, one of the most compelling classical stage actors of his generation. John Douglas Thompson, thank you so much for being with us today. It's great to have you.
Likewise. Thank you for having me, Tom.
John, if a child asks you what Othello is about, what do you tell them as an African-American actor in the year 2016? If a child were to ask you...
If a child were to ask me what the play was about, mm-hmm. That's an interesting question to explain it to a child. But I think I would say that it's a play about a man and a wife where doubt gets introduced and there's a disintegration in the relationship and it ends up horribly. How's that? I mean,
that's a pretty good start.
Yeah, that's a good start. If it was an adult, I'd throw in a few more things, but for a child, I would say it's about a beautiful relationship of love between a man and a woman that ends up ending not so well.
The man, Othello, this general in the Venetian forces there, but a Moor, and Desdemona, his wife, a secret marriage, Iago, who plants the seed of doubt about what's going on. Ayanna Thompson, that Moor part resonates a lot these days when we're so focused, again, maybe always, on race. Is it a play about race? I mean, you wrote the book on Shakespeare, Race in Contemporary America. How do you look at Othello?
Well, I think Othello is fascinating because it's a play that really changes over time. There are different ways of viewing it from the early modern period to, the Civil War era in the United States or apartheid South Africa to now in the 21st century. Othello has been important text in all of those different time periods. And I don't think it's just read as a document that reflects the moment in which it was created. It keeps changing in each of those time periods and has sort of weird holdovers from earlier time periods and then clear breaks with them as well when the performance tradition change. But I do think that it is a play about race and, right? It's mm-hmm. race and power, mm-hmm. race and sexuality, race and gender, race and religion. So I think for me, race ends up being central to it, but it's never the only thing. It's also a story about how storytelling is incredibly powerful, and those who control the narrative can control the people around them and can control the way that others view people around them and how difficult it can be to break out of someone else's narrative about yourself.
Is it fair? Othello is the Moor. Is it fair? Do you think of him, see him in your mind's eye? He's been presented in many ways on stage, but as a black man, Ayanna, or are these time? Is that a time bound construction itself?
It is a time bound construction. But one thing I would like to say, mm-hmm. and I'd be interested to ask John this, since we're both black Americans,
mm-hmm. And we have the same last name,
although we're not related.
No relation. Okay, duly noted.
I think that Black Americans and maybe even young Black British have a very different relationship with Othello, the character, and Othello, the play, than our white colleagues. And I experienced this for the first time in college when I was listening to my brilliant professor give a lecture on Othello. Mm-hmm. And for him, it really had nothing to do with race whatsoever. And I realized, huh, we read a different play.
I mean, how can it not have something to do with race? I mean, you've got Iago who seems to just come in when he tries to break all this up and maybe have some revenge on Othello. He didn't get the promotion he wanted. But, I mean, he comes in there, you know, talking to Desdemona's father. Even now, an old black ram is tupping your white ewe, you know, your daughter covered with a Barbary horse. These to us today sound like full-on racist taunts. Did they not sound something like that then, Ayanna?
No, they did sound like that then. But there was a long tradition in Shakespeare scholarship and in performance where Shakespeare is all things good, right? So he's this great author, and we have to love everything that he did and also reflect the universal humanity out of every single word that he's written. Well, that's just not realistic, of course. And so there were many scholars and performances that tried to de-emphasize anything having to do with race in the play so that it could just be about something that was easier to contain, like jealousy or ambition or being easily duped or you know, the fact that Othello and Iago are warriors and perhaps they don't understand or Othello doesn't understand how to operate in a domestic sphere. So there are ways of highlighting different aspects of the play that de-emphasize race. And I think that was a tradition for a long time.
I mean, John, I assume that we can agree that Shakespeare pulling out and portraying racism doesn't mean Shakespeare is bad. He's a dramatist. He's showing us ourselves. We know it exists.
Well, I never. I do understand the play to be about race. That's obviously in there. It doesn't need to be overemphasized in a production. Mm-hmm. But I thought what was a little bit more prevailing, or certainly much more universal, was this story of the other, which seemed to me to trump race, to trump jealousy. It was really about how we deal with the other, and Shakespeare is the other in this play.
Othello?
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Othello is the other in this play. I was mentioning a couple of other Shakespeare plays where they deal with the other, too, like with Caliban in Tempest. But Shakespeare is the other. Othello is the other in this play, and I found it to be more satisfying as a performer to explore the politics of the other, what that means with Othello coming into this Venetian society, a different man. Obviously, he looks different. He's a black man. He's an African. But also his life story is very, very different. What he's been accustomed to is very, very different. Mm-hmm. He's also someone who's newly found love in his life.
Yes.
And he's not really aware of things that happen in Venice. Obviously, Iago kind of tries to give him some information on those things. But I found it to be much more a stronger journey for me to take if I didn't make it so much about race, because race was already there in the play.
Yep.
So in the productions, at least in two of the productions I was in, we didn't really need to overemphasize that because it was already there. We didn't need to hit it over the head with a hammer. So we focused on this aspect of the other, and it wasn't so much as racism as it was jealousy moving towards profound confusion. And I really wanted to create an Othello that could somehow be, in my wildest dreams, universal. So anybody could look at this play and say, that could happen to me, or that's an experience that I could easily have if those conditions were set up in the same way they are in the play, as opposed to making it just about race, where it can only happen under one particular circumstance.
I mean, Othello's an accomplished man. He's a great warrior. He's a man of great experience in this play, Ayanna. Certainly it universalizes it when you make the distinctions John is making. Can you see teasing race out and away from otherness? Does it make it more universal, or is race important, an important part of the way for us to read it, hear it today?
Well, I mean, there's no one way to read a play or to perform it. And actors have to make decisions in order to put on a production, right? The beauty of being a reader of Shakespeare and just watching productions is that, you know, in my classes, we get to explore all the different kind of ambiguities in the text, which John has to nail down to one thing, right? in order to be able to perform it effectively. Otherwise, it would just look like an insane performance. So I think there are lots of shades in the play that at one time can make it look like it's a universal claim about feeling alienated, and at other times makes it very specific. So when Iago is saying to Othello, hey, you don't know how it works in Venice, right? You're not from here.
You're out of your depth here, buddy.
You're out of your depth here. And Othello says, happily for I am black. Perhaps it's because I'm black. That really, to me, is a very specific moment. You can universalize it to be about how it feels to be alienated in any situation. But this is about feelings of insecurity that are related, directly related to race, that I think are incredibly profound for us in the 21st century as we think about what it means to be a powerful black man in America or anywhere in the world, and how then still feelings of insecurity can be planted in one's brain.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 400 years after Shakespeare, we are looking again at Othello, the Bard's great play of race, sexuality, betrayal, romance, the other, on and on. And we will look later in this hour at Beyoncé's new visual album, Lemonade. My guests are Ayanna Thompson, author of Passing Strange and professor of English at George Washington University. John Douglas Thompson is with us, celebrated for his portrayal of Othello, Obie winner. You can join us as well this hour. How do you understand Othello the Moor? Are you thinking about Shakespeare as we note the 400th anniversary of his death? Can we learn something valuable from 1603 from the Bard about race, sexuality, love, power, today through Othello? John Douglas Thompson, there in New York, Ayanna was just referring to this moment where maybe Othello begins to doubt himself, certainly begins to doubt Desdemona's fidelity, and Iago is planting in a pretty malignant way these ideas, very malignant way, these ideas in his general. Could you read some of us from Shakespeare just there, Act 3, Scene 3, John?
Sure. One second, let me get it here. Okay. Here it is. This fellow's of exceeding honesty and knows all qualities with a learned spirit of human dealings. If I do prove her haggard, though that her jesses were my dear heartstrings, I'd whistle her off and let her down the wind to prey at fortune. Haply, for I am black, and have not those soft parts of conversation that chamberers have, or for I am declined into the veil of years, yet that's not much. She's gone. I am abused, and my relief must be to loathe her. Oh, curse of marriage, that we can call these delicate creatures ours and not their appetites. I had rather be a toad and live upon the vapor of a dungeon than keep a corner in the thing I love for others' uses. Yet, 'tis the plague of great ones. Prerogative are they less than the base. 'Tis destiny unshunnable like death. Even then this forked plague is fated to us when we do quicken. Desdemona comes. If she be false, oh, then heaven mocks itself. I'll not believe it.
Our actor John Douglas Thompson reading there from Shakespeare's Othello. How do you read what's going on in his mind there, John, as the other? I mean, he's saying, oh, Iago's exceedingly honest. He's being set up by Iago here, but the doubt comes right through.
Yeah, the doubt starts to creep in. There's a couple of things. He does say, haply, for I am black. Is that a reason? that my wife would, or Desdemona would, seek out another, you know, seek out another man. He also says, you know, I don't have those soft parts of conversation mm-hmm. that chambers have, so maybe I don't speak the language in the way that it needs to be spoken, or that I am too old. I'm falling into the veil of years. And he says, yet that's not much.
Mm-hmm.
What's really interesting to me about that piece in the context of a production is it is, I think, Othello's only time he's on stage alone talking to the audience. Essentially, he's talking to himself,
yeah.
but it's his soliloquy.
Yes.
And it's there that I think an audience gets to see how his mind works, how doubt tends to create more doubt and concern and move towards Othello really feeling that Desdemona has somehow wronged him.
Mm-hmm.
But what you quickly get on the opposite of that is that he turns right back away from it. So there's all this vacillation. At one point, he's believing it.
He doesn't want to go there.
Yeah, and then he just pushes it away. Once he sees his wife, look at my wife, it's impossible she could be... that's impossible. If she be false, then heaven mocks itself. I'll
yeah.
not believe it.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting moment in the play for an audience to get an understanding of how Othello thinks and how the idea of doubt works on the mind. And true, there is the one racial reference, happily for I am black, but I think the other two references, which are parts of conversation that chambers have and his age, are valid things that any man would represent in an effort to say why I'm doubting this woman that I love. So it's the only time that I think the audience can really see where he's thinking and how he vacillates back and forth, this process in Othello when he gets information like this.
A man of power and accomplishment, but confronted with doubt-inducing, what sort of evil whispering. John,
which any man would have this idea of doubt, particularly men in high positions, as
yeah.
Othello is, to have this doubt creep in.
And you can marry this woman.
He, about the character,
right? You can marry her. He says that we can call these delicate creatures ours, but not their
and
not their appetites. Maybe any man, but still, I mean, as you say, he says happily, not happily here, but happily, like happenstance, for I am black. Let's put it to our listeners. Brad in Fayetteville, Georgia. Brad, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering why the onus is put upon the production to sanitize the reality of racism in this story and how Iago uses racism to go to Desdemona's father on that basis to arouse his being appalled over the fact that this man,
yep.
who happens to be black, this black ram, is doing his daughter. So why sanitize the story? Of course, all these other aspects are prevalent in it, but it's just a way that Iago is using racism in order to accomplish his goal of revenge. He's much like Donald Trump in this regard, in arousing the racism of the constituency to get what he wants, which is power.
You're right on in so many ways there, Brad. I mean, there's no question, John. Iago's using racism, it seems. It's flagrant here. You hear John's question, why is there an onus to minimize that?
I don't think I'm trying to minimize race.
Mm-hmm.
I admit to the fact that race is a big part of the play. I'm saying as a performer,
mm-hmm.
in performing the role, that is not the first thing that I'm dealing with, or that's on my mind. That is not my top priority in the presentation of the role and the presentation of the play. I think the racism that's in the play is there, and I need not, nor the production itself, need to focus particularly on it, because it is there. Shakespeare already wrote it into the play. So we're going to get that without focusing on it.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
I've tried to do as a performer was to focus on some of these other elements, which I felt were being forgotten because everything was going towards race. So I don't want to minimize
it. Yep.
I just don't want to add to it.
Ayanna, what do we know about how race was understood? Here we're talking about a 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. If you go back those four centuries and to his milieu, you know, this was not the globalized world. This was not the multicultural world by and large. Transportation wasn't like that. Of course, there was interaction, but much, much less than we have today. What do we know about how common people thought about race, if they even did, if they'd even seen people of another race. Was Shakespeare playing here with something commonly understood, or was he deploying Iago to introduce an idea to his audiences of racial harsh distinction, racism?
Well, it actually was a global world, and there was a lot of trafficking of goods around the world mm-hmm. and people. And, of course, this is the beginning of the transatlantic slave trade, right? This mm-hmm. started at the end of the 16th century, and it was on people's minds. A great researcher named Imtiaz Habib has done a lot of archival work on the presence of Africans and blacks in England at the time period. And it was much more widespread than was earlier assumed. So while the majority of the people in the audience in the 17th century probably would not have encountered an African, mm-hmm. the global discourse or the discourse in their everyday lives would have made the issue of racial difference and religious difference and ethnic difference on the forefronts of all of their imaginations. So, while it's very different than today, I think you can see some through lines for us, whereas, maybe people today have more interactions with people who are different than themselves. How to categorize what difference means, how to think through what is a human and what is so different as to fall outside that category. I think those things we're still grappling with. And I love the idea of Iago as a Donald Trump, but I would interject one other thing that the beautiful soliloquy that John read so yes. Effectively is that it's not just that doubt is interjected, but that doubt is interjected by someone with whom Othello has had a long, trusted military relationship with.
This is his right-hand man.
That's right. This is his brother in arms mm-hmm. who he has been to battle with over and over and over again. Iago makes it clear that he's traveled around the world with Othello supporting, all of the Venetian efforts. So these two have this close, very tight friendship that, of course, is always built on trust, trusting your life with somebody else. So it's not just that doubt is interjected by anyone. Mm. Othello doesn't seem particularly bothered by the fact that Desdemona is hurling all these racial epithets at him. He doesn't really care. It's mm-hmm. when Iago does it, someone that he trusts, someone that he has this long-standing military relationship
with. But his right-hand man just brings on the evil like nobody's business. I mean, my colleague Jack Beattie is listening in from his New Hampshire area there and reminds us of Coleridge calling this motiveless malignity just kind of beyond racism, something just so deeply malign. What's Shakespeare going for with that? If it's his brother in arms, they've been through all this together. How do you understand that piece, John?
Well, I thought that from my understanding that somehow Iago feels wronged. He's been passed over.
Yes.
I've promoted Cassio over Iago. I can only assume that this was something Iago was expecting and was planning on. It meant a great deal to him. He does suggest somewhere in the play that he thinks that I, Othello, have slept with his wife. I do think Iago has his reasons for taking this thing to Othello and trying to deconstruct this man by introducing information about, all this stuff about Desdemona. So I never looked at Iago as him having nothing to actually come at Othello with.
But he's willing to burn down the whole city, metaphorically, over that slight. I mean, it's such a massive sort of unbounded sense of evil.
It truly is, but that's the Iago that obviously Othello, no one in the play knows that Iago. The audience does, obviously. Mm-hmm. They're introduced to it. Mm-hmm. But he's very clever in the way that he deals with everybody else. He's quite transparent, if you will. So it's not something that I see in Iago. By the time we get to the end of the play, I'm asking, why would he do this to me? Why would he do this? Because I have no idea why he would go to that length. Mm-hmm. But if I were to play Iago, my basis would be being passed over. having been the friend of this man for so long, built this military relationship, this bond, this brotherhood bond, and expecting this position, which who knows would have changed Iago's life, given him a better life, you know, as he's coming to his years within the armed services. So I'd have to build it on that. And that would be enough for me to take it to the length that I take it to.
And pull out everything, including the race car, to destroy his commander and everything around him.
There's something else that Iago has been hiding, whether he wants to reveal it to himself or not, whether it's been in denial, is that he somehow has hated this man. All the time that he served him and built this great bond and friendship, he's harbored a deep hate. Now, that could be racially motivated, purely racially motivated from Iago's perspective. But once again, it's something that no one else in the play sees.
Mm-hmm.
It's the audience. It's a very clever play in the sense that the audience is being led down a path with one of the actors, with one of the performers, but not the other performers on stage, obviously. We don't know this thing about Iago. So it's very clever the way it's set up, and it leads to this whole thing of, you know, when I've been performing it, where the audience knows what Iago has set up, and they're trying to communicate to me somehow that I'm doing the wrong thing.
Watch out.
Do what you're going to do.
Watch out, Othello. Don't do this.
And
it makes
trying to engage with the play.
Yeah.
And it makes very uncomfortable for the audience, because that's actually a comic trope. Right. In a lot of comedies, the audience will be
in on the joke
with one character as opposed to the other.
Right.
And so here the audience is in this incredibly
awkward.
We're
like the gods watching, but we can't.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Alan in Charleston, South Carolina, you're on the air. Thank you for calling, Alan.
Thanks, Tom. I'm very familiar with the play.
Yes.
And also here in Charleston, we're very familiar with both very recent racial tragedy and many, many centuries of it.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, we truly were blessed by the survivors who forgave that awful, nameless individual for what he did. So we know something about tragedy, and we know something about the blessings of people with extreme spiritual gifts.
Of course, at the church in Charleston. Yes.
To the point, Iago may well be the most evil character that Shakespeare ever created, and he uses every means at his disposal to destroy Othello. I think Othello, like Iago, are both dependent on their sense of honor, which is not unusual at all for the military people. So Iago's betrayal, in Dante's eyes, certainly would have put him at the very bottom of the inferno, and I think that's a human universal. And I think, too, that Othello's tragic flaw, in the archetypical Aristotelian sense, was his dependence on his honor. In addition to his extreme loyalty to his friends.
Oh, I'm so glad for your call, Alan. Betrayed by his own honor, flawed Iona tragically there?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking, I hope we can talk about Desdemona, right?
Yes,
because it's not just a play about men. And that's where I think it gets really interesting, about thinking about how do you deal with honor and then how do you deal with love? Like, how do they fit together, or are they always at odds?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 400 years after Shakespeare, we are looking again at Othello in this hour. The Bard's great play, race, gender, betrayal, the other, if you like, and Desdemona, right in the thick of it. We'll look there. We will also look in just a few minutes at Beyoncé's new visual album, Lemonade. John Douglas Thompson is with us from New York. His breakout role, Othello, in 2009. He won an Obie off-Broadway for that betrayal. One of the most compelling classical stage actors of his generation, Ben Brantley writes. Iona Thompson is with us. She is author of Passing Strange, Shakespeare, Race, and Contemporary America. She's at George Washington University and joins us from Washington. Iona, I wish you'd take us right to a reading or two from Desdemona. I think this is Act 1, Scene 3, where she's sort of she's showing her independence, kind of rebelling against his father. Also, her strength. She's ready to go to war alongside her husband, Othello.
Yeah, I mean, she's remarkable. And I think the trick of this play, right, is that, and we've fallen into it, is that you can focus so much on the, you know, intense relationship between Iago and Othello that it's almost as if Desdemona's a nothing, but she's actually quite a
huge,
remarkable mm-hmm. woman, right? Mm-hmm. And we know from Iago and from her father that she has turned down many proposals in the past from other Venetians, mm-hmm. as if she's been waiting for something different and exciting. And when she encountered Othello, who wooed her with his stories of his adventures in his life, mm-hmm. That's what she was attracted to. So I'm going to read two little, and, you know, of course, my reading compared to John's is going to be horrible. But
it's okay.
But
I'll read two, it can't all be John.
It can't be John. Okay, from Act 1, Scene 3, when Othello is talking in front of the Senate and the Duke and explaining how he won Desdemona's heart. And her father says, I can't believe it. She has to be called before us to say. And her father says, where most do you owe obedience? And she says, my noble father, I do perceive here a divided duty. To you, I am bound for life and education. My life and education both do learn me how to respect you. You are the lord of duty. I am hitherto your daughter. But here's my husband, and so much duty as my mother showed to you, preferring you before her father, so much I challenge that I may profess due to the Moor, my lord. So here we get this amazing moment where, you know, Desdemona says to her father, hey, guess what? This is what happens when daughters marry. Just like when my mom married you, you have to move on. You can't, your whole life can't just be about your father. Mm-hmm. And then she goes on when it's clear that Othello must go off to Cyprus to battle with the Turks. And Othello says, all I ask is that you find a good place, a good accommodation that suits her level of breeding. Mm-hmm. And the Duke says, you know, well, then she should stay at her father. Her father says, no. Othello says no. And then Desdemona says, nor would I there reside to put my father in impatient thoughts by being in his eye. Most gracious Duke, to my unfolding, lend your prosperous ear and let me find a charter in your voice to assist my simpleness. The Duke says, okay, what is it that you want? That I did love the more to live with him, my downright violence and scorn of fortunes may trumpet to the world. My heart's subdued even to the very quality of my lord. I saw Othello's visage in his mind, and to his honors and his valiant parts did I my soul and fortunes consecrate, so that, dear lords, if I be left behind a moth of peace and he go to the war, the rights for which I love him are bereft me, and I a heavy interim shall support by his dear absence. Let me go with him.
I mean, off we will go. And they do.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the production that we did in New York,
yes.
we really focused a lot on the romantic love of
yes.
Othello and Desdemona and made Desdemona a center of the play. And I think that's one of the benefits of focusing on many of the other things that are in the play outside of race. You can then, because I've seen other productions where the relationship between Desdemona and Othello is somewhat secondary to the relationship between Iago and Desdemona. And I certainly thought and worked towards having the relationship with Desdemona be stronger than the relationship that I had with Iago, because this is my wife, my new wife,
yes, yes.
brand new in love. But I thought Iona's readings were beautiful, but it does show you in a sense, how rebellious and
yes.
strong,
yes,
of
very
mind
strong, yes,
that Desdemona is, and how aware she is of what she's actually doing.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And in front of all the men in the Senate.
Yeah, John, that's such a great point, and I couldn't agree with you more that so many productions, especially recently, have emphasized how young Desdemona is. They'll often cast actresses right out of drama school, so super, super young, and they'll cast her opposite a much older Othello.
Much older, yeah.
And then it doesn't seem like, it actually doesn't seem probable. Like, why would she... You know, why would she be interested in him? What does he see in her? What is it that's the connection? But I think a more mature
Desdemona really makes the productions work in that sense. I wasn't that much older than the Desdemona that we had.
We're going to go to, interestingly, to Beyonce in just a moment, speaking of all kinds of things, but... Of course,
more mature and
and female and powerful and black African-American in this case. But I mean, here we are. It all ends so sadly and badly with Othello, of course, killing her, killing himself. You've got it ends in blood. And what would you have American viewers of Othello take away most of all in 2016, 400 years after the death of the bard?
I think an important thing to take away, and I was talking to a young psychology PhD student who was doing work on African-American men's psychology, and he said when they were asked to describe themselves, they would use all these great adjectives like baller, like powerful, strong.
Yeah.
And then when they were asked to think about other black men, they would use like less than, not equal to.
Mm.
And this divided psychology, I think, is something that Shakespeare tapped into brilliantly and presciently 400 years ago. And I think that's the thing that we need to reintroduce into our dialogue today.
It is a wonder how his work still lights up our world. We're going to look at more of it in the course of this year, the 400th anniversary year of William Shakespeare's death. I'm so grateful to each of you for being with us. John Douglas Thompson, joining us from New York. Thank you so much for your time and reading and insights today, John. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Ayanna Thompson, author of Passing Strange, professor of English at George Washington University. Ayanna, I can't thank you enough. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we'll talk about Beyoncé's new visual album, Lemonade. This is On Point.
They don't love you like I love you. Slow down, they don't love you like I love you. Back up.
We have known since Super Bowl weekend that something big was coming from Beyoncé. On Saturday night, partnering with HBO and her husband Jay-Z's Tidal streaming service, the biggest name in music dropped Lemonade, an hour-long musical film featuring the music of her new album of the same name, interspersed with the poetry of Warsan Shire and more. It is huge, visually, musically. She moves between hip-hop, rock, and country, topically from the political to the personal. With us to explore Beyoncé's visual album and its cultural moment is Dee Lockett, associate editor at Vulture, New York Magazine's culture website. You can link to her articles, including Beyoncé's Lemonade and the Undeniable Power of a Black Woman's Vulnerability, at our website, onpointradio.org. Dee Lockett, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
For those who haven't yet pulled it up and taken a look, when you dive into Beyoncé's Lemonade, what do we see? What's a visual album?
Well, the visual album is 12 separate songs accompanied by 12 separate videos. Although in the film that was debuted on HBO, she saves Formation for the end after the credits because, of course, you've already seen that one. So really, when you tuned in on Saturday night, if you did, to HBO, you saw 11 completely brand-new songs and completely brand-new videos, just like she did when she surprise-dropped her self-titled album.
And give us a sense of the visuals, the range of what we're seeing. We can hear the music. What are the images?
Well, most of it was filmed in New Orleans. Several of the videos are in black and white. They feature a lot of different settings, mostly outside, also some that are indoors in plantation houses. It's very, very Southern Gothic, as some have described it. It's also very reminiscent of a Terrence Malick film. It's stunning in a word, really. It was directed by a few people, but it was mainly directed by Beyoncé herself. there's just, it's a lot to parse through, but there's some beautiful visual moments throughout the entire film. I mean, for the song Hold Up, you have Beyonce dressed in this beautiful yellow dress, smashing car windows and police surveillance cameras with her bat, which is nicknamed Hot Sauce, which she also referenced in Formation, and we now know what Hot Sauce is. You just have images of her with fire. She's setting fire to things. You have images of her with hundreds of black women raising arms in the sea. It's just, it's a lot. It's beautiful.
Here's Daddy Lessons from Lemonade, the new visual album. It's got a kind of country twang to it, one of the many music genres Beyonce explores on this presentation.
With his gun and his head held high, he told me not to cry. Oh, my daddy said shoot. Oh, my daddy said shoot. With his right hand on his rifle, he swore in on the Bible. My daddy said shoot. Oh, my daddy said shoot.
D. Lockett, what do we get in the visual album presentation of Daddy Lessons?
So the visual part of Daddy Lessons is kind of a three-part thing. She begins it singing in a tunnel with a lone guitar player, and she's kind of just swaying back and forth singing. It's very traditional country. But it's also spliced together with home footage of a younger Beyonce with her father, Matthew Knowles, who she's been estranged from. Mm-hmm. And then it's also, there's images of her in denim jeans and like a white tank top, and she's just riding a horse. It's very, very, very Texas. As she says at the beginning of the song, she repeats the word Texas over and over again, which is, of course, where she's from.
He swore on the Bible, my daddy said shoot. Oh, my daddy said shoot. Meaning, go get it, girl?
meaning, take what's yours.
Mm-hmm.
And not putting up with the grievances of men.
Your headline is Beyonce's Lemonade and the Undeniable Power of a Black Woman's Vulnerability. She doesn't sound like vulnerability here or when her daddy sends her out to get it with a rival.
You know, anger and pain are two forms of vulnerability as well. I mean, mm-hmm. even in the song Hold Up, that kind of anger and that kind of rage and asking over and over again what's worse, looking jealous or crazy, that's vulnerable. It's probably the most vulnerable you can be. You're more vulnerable in that way than when you are in tears, when you've lost all hope, because there's a level of control to that, in a sense. But when you lost all control, that's vulnerable.
What's the cultural moment you see Beyonce speaking to here? Where does she turn it, Dee?
The cultural moment in which song? Or just
well, I guess if you look at it in total. I mean, here we are. This coming into a particular time with a particular series of events and Black Lives Matter and all the rest. Is it speaking directly to that? Do you see it moved by that?
I think she's speaking to a history of Black pain, particularly for Black women. I mean, there's a song on the album called Forward, and in the video, we see the mothers of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and Trayvon Martin holding photographs of their slain sons, all of whom were taken from them and have never, ever been brought to justice, the people who took those lives. And, you know, it's a history of that kind of Black pain. You see them crying, but you also see them standing there, regal as ever, coming to terms with the loss and also coming to terms with their own power, their own resilience, their ability to move past such tragedy and unspeakable pain. I think this is also her way, Beyonce's way, of dealing with her own self-pain. I mean, there are allusions throughout the album and the videos to possible infidelity or some sort of fracture or break-in in her marriage with Jay-Z. I mean, you could take it as literally as you want to, or you could take it as symbolically as you want to,
mm-hmm.
but there's pain that Beyonce's working through, and there's pain she's working through with her father as well.
Here's a clip from the hour-long visual version of Lemonade, debuted on HBO entitled Saturday Night. The video here features the poetry of Warsan Shire.
Mother dearest, let me inherit the earth. Teach me how to make him beg. Let me make up for the years he made you wait. Did he bend your reflection? Did he make you forget your own name? Did he convince you he was a god?
Beyonce on Lemonade, the visual album, reading the poetry of Warsan Shah. She calls on the work of so many here, Dee. This is an interesting innovation.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, we saw her on her last album. She quoted from, and she actually sampled Chimamanda, but on this now she has Warsan Shah, and it's adapted several of her poems, and they're very, very personal, intricate pieces about Black womanhood specifically. So it's so interesting to see the way that she's progressed and drawn on her literary influences. She's also drawing on several different cultural influences. This is a very, very African film. There's a lot of face painting that is drawing on African tradition and African influences. There's obviously New Orleans influences. There's influences on Black magic, specifically New Orleans types of Black magic. You have Mardi Gras Indians in this. It's just, it's breathtaking.
Beyonce creating a cultural moment all her own, but tied in Six Ways to Sunday in the visual album Lemonade. Dee Lockett, associate editor at Vulture. Thank you so much for diving in with us, Dee.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
We go out with Freedom from Lemonade. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Keep on running, 'cause